concentrically circling eyries. Every now and then the duller, darker shape of the extinct volcano would appear to puff a little smoke into the radiant, ever-changing sky. Or perhaps this was just an illusion. Well, possibly, but Scheithus thought not. Soon, Scheithus discovered that the one ice castle was much the same as the next. This one, for example, might well be the stark, shivering, tinkling, cold stack of Cairol Lugoz. Might be, except of course it was not the undead Cairol who waited out the ages in the densely protective sheath of the core, but some other lord. Also, whoever he had been in life, his waiting had long since come to an end, and he was now entirely dead. The ice mummy, frozen, starved, desiccated to a condition way beyond life, the olden vampire was one with all past things, leaving only his shell to represent him as part of the present. Scheithus looked at him through the wavering impurity of the ice and wondered who he'd been. Whoever, it was probably as well he was dead. His thoughts, if there had been any, might have told Arcas and Ferenc secrets Scheithus would prefer them not to know, like why he lay there on his carved ice pedestal propped upon a skeletal elbow, one claw-like hand held up before him as if to ward off some dreadful evil, and his colourless eyes, from which time had bleached out all the scarlet but none of the nameless horror. Aye, even this member of the olden Vampiri horrified by something or someone who had stood here where Scheithus stood even now.
"What do you make of this?"
The sudden echoing rumble of Ferenc's voice caused Scheithus to start. He looked where the giant pointed a taloned hand at a hitherto unnoticed circular borehole in the ice. 7 or 8 inches in diameter, the almost invisible bore seemed to point like an arrow at the preserved Vampiri relic upon his carved couch.
"A hole?" Scheithus frowned.
"Aye," the Ferenc said, "like that of some gross worm in the earth. But an ice worm?"
He kneeled and stuck his hand and arm into the hole, which extended almost to the depth of his shoulder, and withdrawing his arm and sighting along the channel, he added,
"Directed straight at his heart, too."
"More such holes over here,"
Arcas called from a little way around the curve of the core.
"And it seems to me they've been drilled. See the heaped chips where they've spilled out upon the floor?"
And Scheithus thought,
"Such small privations as my dullard friends have known have made them observant."
He followed the core's curve to Arcas and examined the new holes, rather the newly discovered holes, for in fact they could have been made 100, 200 years ago, and sighting along them just as the Ferenc had sighted, Scheithus too noted these perfectly circular runs seemed aimed at the main mass of the ice-shrouded mummy's body. He thought to himself,
"Runs, aye,"
and narrowed his eyes a little as he examined that concept more closely. For upon a time, Scheithus had visited the settlements of itinerant Sagani metalworkers east of the great mountain range, which split Starside from Sunside. These were the tinkers who designed and constructed the fearsome Vampiri war gauntlets. Scheithus had seen the way the colourful travellers poured liquid metal down clay pipes or along earthen sluices into moulds, so that there was that about those boreholes which reminded him of running liquids. Except all of these incomplete runs climbed gentle inclines towards the dead lord, which seemed to indicate that they had not been designed to carry anything to him. Something away from him, then. Scheithus shivered. He was beginning to find his investigations, and more especially his conclusions, damnable. Indeed, there was something about this entire setup which even Scheithus's vampire heart found ominous, oppressive, doom-fraught. And finally, Fess Ferenc voiced his thoughts for him.
"Me and the Welky Vulse, we saw cores where the ice wasn't so thick. In them the boreholes had penetrated right to the centre, and all that was left in there were small bundles of rags, skin and bones."
"What?"
Scheithus frowned at him. Fess nodded.
"As if the one-time inhabitants or slumberers in these frozen stacks had been sucked entire down the bores, all except their more solid bits."
It had been Scheithus's thought exactly.
"But how?"
he whispered.
"How if they were frozen? I mean, how does one draw an entire frozen solid body down a hole which can't even accommodate that body's head.
I don't know.
The Frank shook his own misshapen head.
But still I reckon that's what this old lad was afraid of. What's more, I reckon he died from the fear of it.
Later, a mile closer to the central cone, they entered one of the inner ice castles.
This is one I've not visited before, said the Ferenc, but as close as it is to the old volcano, I'd guess it's a safe bet what we'll find.
Oh?
Scythus looked at him.
Nothing, the Ferenc said knowingly. Just shattered ice, about a gob of black lava, and the empty hole from which some ancient lord's been stolen away.
And he was right. When they finally found the high lava throne, it was empty and its ice sheath shattered into a pile of fused frozen shards. A few fragments of rag were there, but so ancient and stiff that they crumbled at a touch, and that was all. Scythus kneeled at the base of the shattered sheath and examined its broken surface and found what he was looking for. The fluted rims of a good many boreholes, patterned like a scalloped fan, all joining where they converged on the empty niche at the black core. And he looked at Fersenarchus and nodded grimly.
The author of this dreadful thing could have sucked out the unknown lord like the yolk of an egg. But that wasn't necessary, for the sheath was only 2.5 feet thick. So he drilled his holes all the way round until the ice was loosened, then wrenched it away in blocks and shards, and so finally came upon his petrified prey.
And Fess said,
Did I hear you right? Did you say this dreadful thing?
Scythus looked at him, also at Arcus.
I'm Van Fury, he growled, low in his throat. You know me well. There's nothing soft about me. I take pride in my great strength, in my rages and furies, my lusts and appetites. But if this is the work of a man, even one of my own kind, still I say it is dreadful. Its terror lies in the secrecy, the stealth, the gloating, leering malignancy of the slayer. Ah, yes, I'm Vampiri, and if I should be trapped in these icelands, then doubtless I too would develop various life support systems, including a fortress, sophisticated defences, and a source or sources of food. And I too would be as secretive and sinister as needs be. But don't you see? Someone here has already done it, in these icelands. We are coming to the territory of one who victimizes and terrorizes the very Vampiri themselves. This is the dreadful thing I mentioned. Why, the very atmosphere of this place seethes with its evil. And something else, it seems to me that it is evil for evil's sake.
After that, Scythus could have bitten off his forked tongue. Too late, for he fancied he'd already said or hinted far too much. But such was the crushing weight of this place upon his vampire senses, such was its psychic jangle upon his nerve endings, he felt the others would have to be totally insensitive not to have felt it for themselves. Arcus's mouth had fallen open a little while Scythus was speaking. Now he closed it and grunted.
You were always the clever one with the speeches, Scythus. But indeed I have felt the threatening, doomful aura of this place. I felt it when I discovered those several blooded scales and various small parts of my warrior's armoured carapace in the high cave. Also when the bloodless, but well-fleshed and hung with good meat, Lagazis was stolen from the glacial pantry where I'd lodged them. And often I've thought, who is it that watches over me so closely and knows my every move? Is he in my very mind, or do the ice castles themselves have eyes and ears?
It was the Ferenc's turn to speak.
I'll not deny it. I too have felt the mystery of this place. But I think it is a ghost, a relic, a revenant out of time, an echo of something which was but is no more. Look around and ask yourselves, is anything we've seen of recent origin? The answer is no. Whatever deeds were done here were done a long, long time ago.
Arcus snorted again.
And my warrior? And the Lagazi twins?
Fesh shrugged and answered.
Stolen by some thieving ice beast, perhaps a cousin of the pallid, cavern-dwelling sword snout.
Scythus had shaken off his momentary fit of depression, had dispersed the strange and ominous mood which had descended upon him tangible as a bank of fog. The Frank's answer suited him well enough. He did not agree with it, not entirely, but it suited him to let the others think so. except...
So, if there's no sly intelligence involved,
he said,
or no longer involved, as the case may be, then what senses are in moving against the volcano?
Again Fess shrugged.
Best be sure, eh?
He said.
And if there was some sly intelligence at work here, albeit a long time ago, perhaps his works will still be available to us, deep down in the heart of the volcano. One thing's sure, we'll never know unless we go see for ourselves.
Now?
Arcus Leperson was eager, but Scythus cautioned.
I vote we sleep on it. I, for one, have tramped enough for the moment, thank you, and would prefer to tackle the cone fresh from my rest and with a hearty breakfast inside me. Anyway, I note the auroral display is rising to a new peak of activity. That's a good sign. Let the burning sky light the way for us.
I'm with you, Scythus,
the Ferenc rumbled.
But where to bed down?
Why not right here?
Scythus answered.
Within shouting distance, but each of us secure in his own niche.
Arcus nodded.
That suits me.
They separated and climbed to precarious but private ice ledges and niches where no one could come upon them unheard or unobserved, and each in his own place settled down to sleep. Scythus thought to call to himself a warm, living blanket of albinos, then thought better of it. If the bats came, Fess and Arcus would probably find it a suspicious circumstance. Why should Scythus have power over the bats when they had none? Why indeed? It was a question he couldn't answer. Not yet, anyway. He curled himself inside his cloak of black bat fur and munched on flyer flesh. It was scarcely satisfying, but it was filling, and with one eye open and set to scan the ice cavern from Fess to Arcus and back again, Scythus thought,
Ah, but time for the good stuff later.
The good stuff, aye, Fess and Arcus themselves, who for certain would be thinking exactly the same thing about him. And settling down, he began to breathe more deeply, and his scarlet eyes scanned the cavern, and slowly the dreams started to come.
Chapter 5. Blood Relations. Scythus of the Vanthiri dreamed a splendid fantasy. As is often the way with dreams, it was comprised of a great many scenes and themes with little or no explanation, except perhaps as echoes of his waking ambitions. The fantasy had been developing itself for some time in the darker caverns of Scythus's subconscious mind, before suddenly firming into an ordered sequence of scenarios, which were these. It was Scythus's reception, his triumph, his moment of glory. The Lady Charon kneeled naked between his spread thighs, teased his great gonads, caressed and even nibbled, but very carefully, upon the purple bulbous tip of his hugely swollen phallus, and now and then paused to gentle that pulsing rod between her perfect breasts. Sumptuously cushioned, Scythus reclined upon Dramel Doombody's raised bone throne in Charon's eyrie, the last of all the great stacks of the Vamphiri finally his by right of conquest, and looked upon all of those persons, creatures, and possessions who were likewise his to use, abuse, or destroy, as when and how he willed it. Above and beyond the eerie kilometre-high buttresses, battlements, and balconies of fossilized bone, stone, membrane, and cartilage, new stars thronged to join those already dusting the darkening sky. The sun issued its last coruscating fan of golden radiation, where it sank down behind Sunside, and for breathless moments the barrier mountains were thrown into massive, jagged silhouette, while the glaring yellow spikes of their peaks turned purple and finally grey. Then the rapidly elongating shadows of the mountains flowed like monstrous stains across Starside's boulder plains to blot them into darkness, and at last it was that sundown which Scythus had so long awaited. The hour of his great triumph, and of his revenge. as, at a signal, his lieutenants threw back the heavy tapestries from the windows and cut free Karen's sigils so that they went warping and spiralling out and down into the darkness. And they shook out the long, tapering pennants bearing Scythus's new blazon, a vampiric gauntlet clenched and raised threateningly above the glaring sphere, which was Starside's portal to the Helllands, to wave in the thinly gusting currents of air over the Eyrie's higher parapets. And,
"So I will it," he growled, "and so it has come to pass."
And he glared all about, defying all and sundry to deny him his sovereignty, if they dared. And yet in his heart, Scythus knew that the victory wasn't his, not in its entirety. He knew he couldn't claim he was its sole engineer, or that he alone had whelmed the strange forces and alien magic of the Dweller. No, for he'd required a deal of help for that. Scythus couldn't remember exactly how the fight had been won, but he did know that he'd had a powerful ally who was here with him even now. Since he seemed to be the only one in any way aware of that other, however, and since he alone of all men was fit to command, fit to proclaim himself warlord of the new Vampiri, what difference did it make? A wraith may not usurp a man. He narrowed his eyes and glanced to the right and back a little, but not so obviously that anyone would notice, and peered a moment at the dark hooded thing in its black cloak where it stood close by watching all that transpired. It was a black, evil thing, and entirely unknown and invisible to all save Scythus. Yet this was the creature which had made Starside's conquest possible. Scythus felt nothing whatsoever of gratitude, but merely scowled, for out of nowhere it had come to him that his secret, faceless ally, his invisible familiar, was the true master here, and he himself a mere figurehead, which irritated him and turned his victory sour. For he was Vampiri and territorial, and there simply wasn't space in this or any other world for two warlords. Galvanized by some weird frustration, suddenly Scythus started to his feet. His prostrate thralls and their kneeling overseer lieutenants rose with him, though all of them, masters and minions alike, shrank back from his severity of gaze. And four warriors in dully glinting armour hissed their alarm at such a flurry of movement, but nevertheless held to their positions in the far corners of the great hall. At Scythus's feet, the Lady Karen shrank back from her master. Her scarlet gaze seemed partly adoring, aye, and she was treacherous as ever, but mainly fearful. He kicked her, sprawling out of his way, and strode alone to the high-arched windows. Out there, the dizzy aerial levels were now alive with entire colonies of smoking, furred Desmodus bats, like clouds of excited, darting midges alongside Scythus's gigantic, sky-spurting warriors. Also, rank upon rank of manta-shaped flyers in ornate, decorative trappings, with lieutenants and high-ranking thralls riding, seated proud in saddles tooled with Scythus's gauntlet sigil. It was an airborne display of his power in the wake of his greatest victory. Scythus stood there a moment, arms akimbo and held high, and watched the fly past like a general inspecting his troops. Then he turned his hooded crimson eyes westward to light upon the dweller's garden, or rather the high saddle in the grey hill where once a garden had blossomed. Aye, but that was yesterday, and now flames leapt there and black smoke boiled skyward, and the underbellies of clouds where they scudded across the peaks were ruddy from the inferno blazing below them. Scythus had vowed it and willed it into being, and now it was real. The garden was burning, and its defenders were dead? No, not all of them. Not yet. And,
"Bring them to me,"
the dreaming vampire commanded of no one in particular.
"I would deal with them now."
A half-dozen lieutenants hastened to obey, and in a little while a pair of prisoners were led into Scythus's presence. Massive, he dwarfed them. Of course he did, for he was Lord of the Vampiri. He hosted a vampire in his body and brain, while his captives were merely human. Or were they? For even now there was that defiant something in their bearing which in itself might also be Vampiri. Then Scythus saw their eyes and knew the astonishing truth. Ah, and how was this for revenge? For there is nothing so delightful to a vampire than to torment, torture, and tap the life fluids of another or others of his kind. And
Dweller,
Scythus said, his voice so softly threatening it was almost a whisper,
Dweller, come take off your golden mask, for I know you now even as I should have known you right from the start. Ah, but your magic had me fooled just as it fooled us all. Magic? No such thing but the true art of the great vampire. For who else but a master of every vampiric talent, aye, and then some, would dare to wage a one-man war against all the great lords that were? And who else but the most crafty, crafty vampire, might even have won such a war?
The Dweller made no answer, but simply stood there in his loosely flowing robes and golden mask, behind which his red eyes burned, and Scythus, believing he saw terror in those half-hidden eyes, smiled a grim smile. Oh yes, for whether or not there was terror there now, he knew that there would be soon enough. As for the other prisoner, Scythus would never forget this one, for he was not only a Hell-lander, but also the Dweller's father, who had stood side by side with his son in the devastating Battle of the Garden, when the Vampiri had been swatted out of starside skies and crushed like so many gnats. There was more. When fighting was over and all the great eyries of the Vampiri had been levelled, all bar the bitch Charons, Scythus had seen this one with the selfsame lady in these very chambers, Charon's private chambers, as they had been at the time, so that Scythus had wondered,
are they lovers?
Well, perhaps they had been and perhaps not. It could be that they'd simply been allies against Scythus and his armies of Vampiri lords, and as a reward for her part in his defeat, her Aerie had been spared, but only to become Scythus's in the fullness of time, or everywhere else had become Scythus's. He supposed that one way or the other it made little difference, except that for some ill-defined reason, he really would like to know whether or not this Hell-lander had known Charon and been in her. Well, that was a question he could resolve easily enough. She sprawled beside the bone throne where he had left her, and now he called out,
Charon, come to me.
She made to stand up, but he quickly added,
no, crawl.
Luscious body oiled and gleaming in the light of flaring flambeau, with only her golden bangles and rings to cover her figure, which her vampire had made irresistible, she obeyed. Her great bush of pubic hair was a glistening copper tangle, her stains of her areola and spiked nipples were dark as bruises against the pale lull of her elastic breasts. Ever proceeding in the undignified animal fashion which Scythus demanded, still her lithe loveliness could not be disguised. When she was close to him, Scythus quickly reached down and bunched the mass of her red hair in his hand, jerking back her head and yanking her to her feet. She made no sound, no protest, but the Dweller leaned forward a little, a strange attitude or posture like a dog balanced on his hind legs, and Scythus thought he heard a low growl rumbling behind the mask. Had he aroused the Dweller's passions, and if so, what about those of his Hell-lander father? Now, still holding Charon upright, so that she stood upon her crimson-nailed toes, Scythus deliberately looked away from the Dweller and into the strange, sad eyes of his puny-looking father. He cocked his great head on one side inquiringly.
And so you're the Hell-lander who caused me so much trouble in the garden, eh? Well, little man, it strikes me that you and your son were lucky that time, and that if you're the best they have going for them behind the sphere gate,
Then it's high time the Vampiri went through into the Helllands and showed them what we can do. Except, I have to admit, there's something I can't quite fathom. I mean, a creature like you, small, soft, puny, with the pulpy parts of a virgin boy. And you'd have me believe you've been into this?
He knotted Karen's hair that much tighter in his great fist, lifting her higher until she was obliged to dance on the very tips of her toes.
What? And live to brag about it?
Scythus's derisory laughter grated like a hot iron in ashes. The Helllander stiffened and his scarlet eyes widened a very little. His mouth twitched in one corner, his pale flesh turned paler yet. But he found strength to suppress the cold fury which Scythus's scorn had momentarily induced in him. And finally, in a small, quiet voice, he answered, "You must believe what you will. I neither confirm nor destroy anything."
Such negativity!
Scythus took it as a sign of the Helllander's impotence, for if he and Karen had been lovers, then doubtless he'd delight in boasting how she was his cast-off, which was the way of it with the Vampiri. In payment for which insolence, Scythus would have him gutted with middling sharp instruments, and beyond his living eyes feed his smoking entrails to a warrior. But however impotent he may or may not be, still the vampire lord's question went unanswered.
"Very well," Scythus shrugged. "Then I shall assume she means nothing to you. If I thought she did, I would cut away your eyelids so that you couldn't close them, and hang you in silver chains from the walls of my bedchamber, where you'd have no choice but to observe each smallest intricacy and nuance of her lovemaking, before she died from it."
At which moment, even as he said this thing,
"Don't!"
the warning echoed like a gong struck in Scythus's mind, and he knew its source at once. Glaring across the hall at the dark-hooded thing, he saw that where before the interior of its hood had been black and impervious as granite, now the sulphur orbits and scarlet pinpricks of his eyes were visible, unblinking, burning their message into his mind.
"Don't drive them too far. I hold them enthralled, their powers suppressed, but goading them is like thrusting sharp staves under a warrior's scales. It makes them unstable, galvanizes them, weakens my hold upon them."
And Scythus sent back,
"But they're whelmed, conquered, whipped like dogs, which no one knows better than you, for you hold their minds like grapes in your hands, to peel or crush as you will. As well as this, I have warriors here and my many lieutenants and thralls, aye, and all of my creatures without, thronging on the night wind. Now tell me, pray, what have I to fear?"
"Only your greed, my son, and your pride," the other answered.
"But did you say your warriors, lieutenants and thralls, yours and not ours? Have I no part in your triumph, then? There were two of us, Scythus, remember, and yet now you talk of I, when you can only mean we. A slip of the tongue, obviously. Ah, but then, the tongues of all the Vampiri are forked, are they not?"
In answer to which Scythus hissed,
"What do you want from me?"
"Only that you are not prideful," the dark-hooded thing told him. "For I too was prideful in my time, only to discover that it goes before a fall."
It was all too much. Tell a vampire not to be prideful. Restrict the towering enhanced emotions of a being such as Scythus? But he was Vampiri. And to the dark-hooded thing,
"I vowed Karen's death in a certain fashion at my hands in my bed. My triumph will not be complete until it has come to pass, or as nearly as possible. Also, the Dweller and his father have been my mortal enemies, which I intend to destroy."
"Then destroy them,"
said the other, his eyes blazing up huge, as if gorged on fire.
Kill them now, but don't torture them, for it could be that if they are driven to it...
Yes?
I think that even they do not know their own strength, their own powers.
Scythus was astonished.
Their strength? But can't you see that they are weaklings? Their powers? Plainly they are powerless. Aye, and I shall prove it.
He released Charon's hair, and she collapsed at his feet. And, in his dream, Scythus again turned to his captives, who, throughout his conversation with the dark-hooded thing, had stood as if a frozen tableau held fast by vampire thralls.
There was a time,
he told the pair then,
when the bitch Charon betrayed her rightful master, which is to say myself, and all of the vampiry at a stroke. Betrayed us? What? Her treachery almost destroyed us. There and then I vowed that when times and fortune had changed, I would slip a siphon into her living heart and drain her blood sip by sip. Also, I vowed that while I emptied her of her juices, I would fill her with my flesh. A double ecstasy for a most undeserving lady. So I vowed it, so let it be.
And to his lieutenants,
go, bring me my couch of black silken sheets and the sharp, slender golden straw which you shall find upon my pillow.
Scythus's couch was carried in by 6 powerful thralls. A fawning lieutenant proffered a small silken cushion bearing a slim wand of gold tubing, whose funnel mouthpiece reflected the flaring torchlight. Scythus took the golden straw, threw off his robe, and beckoned Charon to the couch. But as he moved to join her there, again there came that rumbling growl from the deep in the dweller's throat, and again Scythus sensed this oddly postured being leaning towards him, like some nameless threat. The vampire lord paused a moment, cocked his head in mocking, silent inquiry, and smiled an utterly inhuman smile before seating himself upon the couch beside the apparently enthralled Charon. She lay there in a sort of vacant paralysis, with her scarlet eyes fixed upon him. But her breathing was shallow. Palpitating and gleaming beads of perspiration were starting from her brow in morbid anticipation. Catching up her left breast, Scythus lifted it and examined the pale rib cage beneath, then slipped the sharp tip of his golden straw between 2 of her ribs and eased it towards the pounding centre of her body. As a bubble of her dark red blood formed around the siphon at the point of entry, so Scythus's vampire lust brought him to massive erection. He released his partially inserted siphon and gripped the inside of Charon's right thigh with a huge hand, squeezing the flesh there as an indication that she should open herself to him. Which was when he felt her first tentative rejection of his will, and the resistance of others bolstering her resolve, and sensed the suddenly converging foci of forces previously unsuspected. The dark-hooded thing sensed them too, crying out in Scythus's mind,
I warned you!
But too late, for the vampire lord's dream fantasy had now turned to sheerest nightmare. For the third time, Scythus heard the dweller's now unmistakable animal growl and shot him a wide-eyed glance, in time to see him wrench himself free from the pinioning grip of his guards, then reach up and tear his own golden mask from his face. Except, whatever Scythus had expected, it was not there beneath that mask. And as for the face which was there, that resembled nothing even remotely human. No, for bristling and flat-eared, it was the face or visage of a great grey wolf, but its blood-gorged eyes were still those of the vampiri. Its wrinkled, quivering muzzle frothed and dripped saliva, teeth like the blades of small scythes gleamed where the wet, writhing muzzle revealed them. In the next moment the snarling beast, was this really the dweller, had turned and snapped at an astonished former guard, and even while Scythus gaped, the thing's jaws closed like a steel trap on the lieutenant's arm and sheared it below the elbow. And then on, all was madness. As the huge, upright creature more than nearly completed its metamorphosis into a grey-furred, lupine form, so its voluminous robes shredded like so much rotten cloth to reveal its sheer size. It was a wolf, yes, but as large as a big man. Scythus's thralls, having already witnessed the monster's speed and savage efficiency, quickly backed off. Hastening their retreat, the great wolf fell to all fours and launched itself at another lieutenant, crunching effortlessly upon his head. And through all of this, the vampire lord on his couch was only too well aware that fortune's tide had turned, and that other inexplicable reversals were even now in motion. Nevertheless, he determined that some of his dream fantasy, at least, should be made to work for him. And crushing Charon in the circle of one great arm, he gripped the golden straw where it was poised to pierce her heart and prepared to thrust it home. He gripped it and at once snatched back his trembling hand. For a second metamorphosis was even now taking place in Charon, which was no less rapid and awesome than that of the dweller into a wolf. Moreover, it was loathsome. As if Scythus's siphon had poisoned her and brought her on some incredible swift aging process, or corruptive catabolism, Charon's flesh was collapsing before the vampire lord's eyes. Her arms became yellow-veined sticks from which her bangles clattered loosely onto the floor. Her scarlet eyes turned a sick, sunken yellow under matted eyelashes. Her skin was suddenly corrugated as the skin of dried fruit.
"What?"
he croaked as her ravaged lips drew back in a travesty of a smile and showed him her leprous forked tongue, shriveled gums and loose decaying teeth. It wasn't a question proper, but she answered it anyway, and her voice was a morbid cackle as she reached for Scythus's shrinking parts and said,
"My lord, I'm ready for you."
Galvanized into frenzied activity, Scythus slapped the flat of his hand on the siphoned mouthpiece and drove it home into her body, and a gurgling stream of stinking pus at once jetted out to splash against and adhere to his shuddering flesh. With an inarticulate cry, he staggered to his feet, pointed at the dissolving, liquefying thing on the couch, and commanded,
"Destroy it! Remove it now! The refuse pit!"
But no one seemed to be listening. Scythus's lieutenants and other thralls were in a turmoil. The dweller's wolf facet was ravaging among them like a fox among chickens, and as for the dweller's hell-lander father, the vampire lord could scarcely believe his own eyes. The pair of hulking vampiric aspirants who had dragged this small, unassuming human being in here were now slumped, smouldering shreds of blasted flesh puddling the flagged floor with their ichor. And the magician, oh yes, for this surely was magic, who had cindered them, was at the window, gazing out on Starside's night skies and ruin-scarred plains with devastating eyes. For where and whenever his gaze enlightened and lingered, it brought fresh ruin, and all across the sky in the deepening gloom of sundown, Scythus's new vampiry hordes were exploding into fiery tatters and raining their debris down among the shattered stacks of their own forebears. Raging his frustration, Scythus discovered himself robed again, with his gauntlet at his hip. Knowing what must be done, that he alone had the measure of the dweller and his father, he fitted his deadly weapon to his hand and, in tradition of the olden vampiry, rushed at them to cut them down. And why not? For they were only flesh and blood, after all, just as the great white bear of the Icelands had been flesh and blood, and, as the vampire lord knew only too well, all flesh is weak, even vampiry flesh, in the right circumstances. In Scythus's mind, the dark-hooded thing heard his chaotic blood thoughts and said,
"Fool!"
But Scythus wasn't listening. He came upon the Hell-lander first and swung his gauntlet, which froze in mid-air as if time itself had stopped. And then Scythus saw that time had simply stretched itself and that his monstrous gauntlet crept around the intervening distance in a maddeningly slow motion.
The dweller's father saw it coming, and his strange sad eyes turned, but oh, so very slowly, to burn upon Scythus's face. And the scarlet eyes of his son, the great changeling wolf, were likewise upon Scythus from where that slavering creature floated on the air, caught at the high point of its spring. In the manner of the Vampiri, the pair spoke to Scythus in his raging, blood-drenched mind, and not only them but the dark-hooded thing too, all saying the same thing.
You have destroyed us all, your ambition, your passion, your pride.
Die!
Scythus replied, as his gauntlet collided little by little with the Helllander's head and slowly shattered its bright core. Aye, bright, bright and blinding and deadly as a furnace sun itself. For there was no blood, no bone, no grey and pulpy brain in the magician's head at all, nothing but golden fire, like the seething, searing nuclear fire of the sun. Indeed, it was the sun, endlessly expanding out of the small destruction of the Helllander to encompass and destroy everything. Scythus started awake, felt the ice against his flesh, and thought for a moment that it was searing golden fire. He cried out, and 1,000 fragile icicles shattered and came tinkling down from the ice castle's fantastic ceiling. In the next split second, the vampire lord saw where he was and remembered what he was doing here, and as his nightmare receded and reality closed on him, so his breathing and the pounding of his heart gradually slowed. Then he scanned across the frozen expanse of the ice castle and found the dark forms of Fess Ferenc and Arcus Leperson in their niches, and saw that the former had likewise come awake. And now the Ferenc's gaze met his across the glittering ice-shattered vault.
"Dreaming, Scythus?"
that one called out to him, his words chasing themselves to and fro in the bitter, echoing air of the place.
"An omen, perhaps? You cried out, and it seemed to me you were afraid."
Scythus wondered if the dream had been self-contained, as his inward-directed thoughts, or if Fess had been listening in on it. He hated the idea that anyone should spy on him, especially in his subconscious, where the seeds of all his ambitions, indeed his intentions, were stored in darkness, awaiting their germination.
"An omen,"
he eventually answered, but quietly, hiding what confusion lingered still.
"No, I think not. Nothing portended, Fess. A pleasurable dream, that's all. Of woman flesh and sweet traveller blood."
"Of the Lady Charon rotting on my couch. The entire Vampiri race wiped out in the sunburst of an alien mind."
"Heh,"
the other grunted.
"I dreamed only of ice. I dreamed I was frozen in an ice tomb, and that some unknown thing was melting its way into me."
"Then it's as well my cry of sweet pleasure woke you up,"
said Scythus.
"Ay, but not too early,"
the Ferenc grumbled.
"Arcus sleeps on. In this he's the wise one. Let's drift a further hour or two before we're up and about."
Scythus agreed, and grateful that the giant had not read him, he settled down again and closed an eye. And again Scythus dreamed, except this time, even more certainly than the last, he knew it was much more than any common dream. The setting was a meeting between himself and the being known as Shaitan the Fallen, who he recognized at once as that self-same dark-hooded thing who had been his sinister frowning familiar, perhaps even his alter ego, in his nightmare of frustrated revenge. He was aware of the thing as a shadow among lesser shadows in a cavern of black rock, unsuspected except for the red glow of his eyes where they floated in luminous yellow orbits. What he, Scythus, was doing in such a place he could not say, except he felt he'd been called here. Yes, that was it. He was not here entirely of his own free will, but mainly because this enigmatic being had called him here. And, as if to confirm that thought,
"Scythus, my son,"
said the dark-hooded thing, whose true voice was deeper, darker, and probably more deceiving than any Scythus had ever heard before.
"And so at last you've answered me. Difficult to reach you, my son,
through that clever deflective screen of yours, else I had known you and called you here long before now.
Scythus's vampiric eyes and awareness were accustomed now to the gloom of the place. Indeed, he saw and sensed as well as ever, which is to say very well indeed, as a cat at night or Desmodus on the wing. The darkness made no difference. In fact, and with regard to his whereabouts, it merely served to confirm his first instinctive guess that he was in some natural chamber, deep in the belly of the slumbering volcano, which would appear to make Shaitan the lord of these subterranean regions. In such close proximity, the other read his thoughts as if they'd been spoken words and answered,
"But of course, just as I have been since, a long, long time."
Scythus peered intently at the crimson-eyed shadow, which was Shaitan. It was strange, but for all his vampire-enhanced awareness, he saw only an outline of the other's form. No fault of his senses were not impaired. Shaitan must be shielding his physical self in a manner like to Scythus guarding his thoughts. But Shaitan the Fallen? Could it really be? Was it really possible for any creature to live so long? He made up his mind that indeed it must be, for there he stood in the presence of just such a one, and—
"This isn't just a dream," said Scythus then, with a shake of his head. "I can feel your presence, and know you are real. That same Shaitan of whom Kaeror Lugoz was and is so mortally afraid, the ancient being out of the first annals of vampiric legend? You were banished here in prehistory, and you live here still?"
"All true,"
the other answered, and darkness stirred where he stood, as if he had offered a casual shrug.
"I am that same Shaitan, the so-called unborn, who was and is your immemorial ancestor."
"Ah," said Scythus, as truth finally dawned.
"We are of one blood."
"Indeed, and obviously so. You stand out from the others like a meteor speeding through the stirless stars, such as I stood out in that distant time when I fell to earth. And our ambitions are the same, aye, and our intelligence. I am your origin, Scythus, and your future, and you are mine."
"Your future? Our futures are bound up together?"
"Inextricably."
"Outside of these icelands, you mean? In more civilized places?"
"In Starside and in worlds beyond Starside."
"What?"
Scythus was taken aback, for there was something here which smacked of that earlier dream.
"Worlds beyond Starside? You mean the Hell Lands?"
"For a start."
"And you know of such places?"
"Upon a time I was the inhabitant of just such a place. But that was before I fell, or was thrown, to Earth."
"And you remember it?"
"I remember nothing of it."
The dark-hooded thing growled, moving marginally closer, and there was that about its motion, as if it were the very flux of intelligence, a sentient viscosity, which caused Scythus to take a pace to the rear.
"My memory, all memory, was robbed from me when I was cast out."
"No memory of what you did? Who and how you were?"
And again the thing moved closer, and once more Scythus backed away, but not too far, for fear he should back right out of his own dream.
"Only my name, and that I was vain and proud and beautiful,"
said Shaitan, conjuring more echoes of that former dream.
"But it was a long time ago, my son, and given time all things change. I too have changed."
"Changed?"
Scythus tried hard to understand.
"You're no longer vain, no longer proud. But even the least of the vampiri know such vices, and enjoy them. They always will."
Shaitan slowly shook his hooded head, which Scythus knew from the movements of his crimson eyes in their yellow orbits, and the only parts of the creature which were visible through the warp of his inky, impenetrable mental shield.
"No longer beautiful," he said.
"But it's the same for all of us,"
Scythus answered.
"We know we are not beautiful and accept it. And anyway, what was beauty to do with power? Why, there are those of us who even foster our ugliness as a measure of our might."
Inadvertently, he thought of Vulse Peniscu. Shaitan picked the picture clean out of his mind.
Aye, that one was ugly, but he himself willed it. I did not. And physically and mentally hideous as the Vanthiri are, still by comparison they are beautiful.
And for the third time he came closer. Shaitha stood his ground, but groped for his gauntlet. It was a dream true, but he'd not yet relinquished all control.
Do you wish to harm me?
He said.
On the contrary,
the other answered,
for we've a long way to go together. But this art I practice is weary. It were better if you knew me as I am.
Then show me yourself.
I was preparing to,
Shaitan answered.
Indeed, I was preparing you.
Enough, said Shaithas. I am prepared.
So be it, said his ancestor, and relaxed his hypnotic will. What Shaithas saw then shocked him awake a second time, as if the sleeping volcano itself had erupted under his feet. He started up, gasping in his ice niche, wide-eyed and astonished by the castle's luminous light after the dream darkness of the cone's core. With a chill in his black heart spawned more, far more, of what the dark-hooded thing had shown him than of any mundane or merely physical condition. And because the dream had been more than a dream, in fact a visitation, it didn't fade back into some subconscious limbo of obscurity, but remained sharp, etched in the eye of his mind as clear as the sigils on an eyrie's fluttering banners and pennants. Shaithas himself, a monster in every respect, was not a creature to shock easily. Where the Vampiri were concerned, fear and horror were more or less defunct concepts, eradicated and replaced by rage. Adrenaline was rarely released into a vampire's system to encourage or enable flight, but usually to trigger his animal passions so that he would stand and fight, viciously, brutally. An awareness of their superiority had been bred into Starside's vampires through all the long centuries of their sovereignty, when it was indisputable that, of all their world's creatures, they were far and away the dominant species, much as common man was dominant in his world. But the fact remained that Shaithas had once been a common man, a traveller vampirized when Shaidor Shagasporn renamed him, made him his chief lieutenant, or son, and gave him his egg, and as such he'd learned what fear was all about. Even now, after half a millennium, he still remembered, if only when he slept. For however monstrous a man may become, the thing that frightened him as a youth will continue to do so in his dreams. What had frightened Shaithas the most in those early days of his abduction from Sunside, in that time now 500 years in the past, before Lord Shaddar coughed his scarlet egg into his throat and changed him forever, had been the many and monstrous anomalies of Shaddar's lofty eyrie. The cartilage creatures and gas beasts, the entirely unthinkable siphoneers, the vast vats in the lower levels of the stack where trogs and travellers alike became flyers or warriors or yet weirder facets of Shaddar's hybrid experimentation. For the vampire lord had delighted in showing to Shaithas, at the time a young as well innocent traveller, his most nightmarish creations, and in torturing his mind with the half-threat that one day he too might be a diamond-headed flyer, armor-scaled warrior, or flaccid, pulpy siphoneer. Morbid distortions and abnormalities such as these, then, had been the harbingers of Shaithas's worst nightmares during those early days of Vampiri apprenticeship. But in time, as he himself ascended to the Eyrie's throne room, such fears had receded, been suppressed, had succumbed to the vampire in him, which bade him become a maker of monsters in his own right, an art in which finally he excelled. And his flyers had been the most weirdly graceful, his warriors ferocious beyond any previous ferocity, and his other creations and experiments varied, so that it was only in dreams, out of his youth, that he remembered and took fright at such things, except that even in the most vivid and awe-inspiring of these, nothing that memory had conjured had been half as monstrous as that which the dark-hooded thing had shown him. Ugly, Shaitan had called himself. But there is ugly, and there is ugly, and as for hybridism.
Scythus pictured again the thing which had stood there when his ancestor relaxed his hypnotic shield to let himself to be seen as he really was, an abomination which not even the most perverse or insane vampiric mind might envisage, made all the worse through its reality. It had been what? A man-sized slug or leech, corrugated, glistening black and mottled green-grey, but rearing upright like a man, a vampire, yes, such as might develop from an egg inside a man or a woman, but grown huge beyond all reasonable measure, so that Scythus had wondered,
but if this grew inside a man, then what became of its host?
Then, as a grotesque but mainly vague picture of the thing, made vague by its virtue of its obscenity, scarred itself into his mind, so he'd become aware of something of its finer detail, which in the next moment had sufficed to shock him awake. The thing? No, he must not think of it as a thing alone, but also as Shaitan, his ancestor, had rubbery limbs, some of which ended in suckered tentacles. Others, however, did not, but were equipped with vestigial human and other animal parts, mummied hands and withered, rudimentary feet, and even a gleaming bone claw, and it was these parts, and also Shaitan's flat composite face on its spade-shaped cobra head, which repulsed Scythus the most and brought about the resurgence of his long-forgotten phobia. For he knew that hybridism he saw here was not that of some vampiric lord's experimental vats, but of nature, or rather of the vampire's unnatural tenacity, its determination to cling to life, in circumstances however desperate, through travails and triumphs down all the nameless ages. Aye, for Lord Shaitan had grown simply too ancient for the accommodation of mortal human flesh, and his original body had wasted away to be replaced almost in its entirety by the metamorphic organism which was his vampire, which was indeed now himself. Ugly? The result was hideous, especially so to Scythan in his dream, for there it had been the embodiment of every nightmare of his apprenticeship. As to how he knew the fate which had befallen Scythan in his ice-bound isolation, his evolution, no, devolution from man-vampire or vampiric to pure vampire, that had been written in the vast intelligence, hatred and sheer evil of the leech thing's scarlet eyes, unblinking under their cobra hood. Not the unbridled, mindless hatred so often seen in the seething eyes of a warrior, or the vacant, lidless stare of a hugely nodding flyer, and certainly not the watery, vapid gaze of a siphoneer. But such evil intelligence that Scythus had known this thing was no morbid experiment but a true mutation. He had known, too, with reinforced certainty, that indeed this was Shaitan the Unborn, called the Fallen, for of all vampiric legends there was one of universal prevalence, that, to the innermost core of his being, Shaitan had been evil above all other men and creatures. Chapter 6. Dark Liaison. Scythus's mental guard was down, his mind accessible as he emerged more fully from sleep. And there was someone there, a dark presence, to take advantage of his confusion. It was Shaitan, of course. Even at a distance his gurgling venomous voice was unmistakable.
Evil? Do you say I was evil? No, I was wronged by the Vampiri, my own kind. For I was stronger than them, and they feared me. And you, son of my sons, do you also fear me? See how you start awake from me, as if I were some doom come upon you rather than your salvation.
Scythus went to close his mind, and hesitated. His hideous ancestor was the master of the dead volcano, wasn't he? What harm could he do from there? This could well be the perfect opportunity to learn more about him without alerting the others to his presence. Shaitan picked all these thoughts out of Scythus's mind and chuckled monstrously.
Hi,
he gurgled.
For it would never do to let them in on your secret. Not until it's too late, or at least too late for them.
Scythus lay back, narrowed his eyes and scanned across the glittering expanse of the ice castle's hollow heart to focus upon the huddled shapes of Fesfarenc and Arcus Leperson where they slept on. He reached out with his Vampiri awareness to touch upon the flimsy mental barriers they'd erected about their sleeping minds, satisfying himself that they were in fact asleep. And finally, he answered that dark intelligence which had proclaimed itself his ancestor.
"I think I prefer you this way, Shaitan. Not out in the open, as it were, and not cloaked in dreams. But it was clever of you to break in on me like that. My so-called peers among the Vampiri were never up to it."
"They were not of your blood?"
Shaitan at once answered.
"Or should we say, they were not of mine? Our minds mesh like those of twin brothers, Shaithas. It's a sign that you're a true son of sons, so that we're as one. We were meant to be as one and triumph over all adversity, and then go on to victories unimaginable."
"I?"
Shaitha said wonderingly.
"In this and in other worlds, as you have stated. I think it would be interesting to know more about that. Indeed, it would interest me greatly to retake Starside from the alien enemies who dwell there now, and to avenge myself upon them. Now tell me your thoughts, for you've hinted we've a way to go together. Have you planned our first steps along that way? And how do I know I can trust you anyway? Your legends are infamous even among the Vampiri, who themselves are not much known for straight dealing."
Again, Shaitan's loathsome chuckle.
"My son, you'll trust me because you have to. Because without me, you're stuck here. And I shall trust you for the same reason. But if a token of my goodwill is required, have you not already seen enough of it? Who was it sent his small albino bats to you to keep your sore bones warm while you slept? And who was it disposed of one of your enemies whose intentions were dire against you, to say the least?"
"An enemy?"
Shaitha's raised a mental eyebrow.